Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Tara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss a new Guidelines in Cardiovascular Research article by Lindsay et al. Titled, Guidelines for In Vivo Mouse Models of Myocardial Infarction. This article was published November 17th, 2021. Joining me today are Associate Editor Jason Carter and authors John Calvert, Christine DeLeon-Pinnell, Dominic Del Rey, Richard Gumina, Stephen Jones, Ganesh Halade, Zam Kasiri, and Crystal Ripplinger. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. Coronary artery disease continues to be a leading cause of morbidity and mortality and an area of keen interest to AJP heart and circulatory physiology. Due to the various risk factors and other influences, corresponding ischemia can range from low flow to no flow, and the length of ischemia can be short duration or permanent occlusion. Clinically, the optimal therapy is reperfusion to restore blood flow, yet nearly 1 in 4 patients will not be reperfused due to various reasons, including lack of patients seeking medical attention early enough or a lack of successful reperfusion. Fortunately, the scientific community has developed both reperfused and non-reperfused myocardial infarction models in animals that have advanced this important area of research. The purpose of this guidelines paper was to develop a consensus document that might put forward a set of uniform strategies for inducing and evaluating reperfused or non-reperfused MI models, as well as to establish benchmarks regarding left ventricular remodeling and function that arise in response to myocardial infarction. This fits with calls from the National Institutes of Health and other leading health organizations to strengthen experimental rigor and reproducibility, with the ultimate goal of expediting scientific breakthroughs and positively impacting human health. Let me start with Zam, who served as one of the corresponding authors for this significant undertaking. Zam, why did the team want to put together this guidelines? What was the impetus for it? And can you summarize the major differences between this guidelines paper and the one published in 2018 on cardiac ischemia?
Thanks, Jason. That's a great question. So in this article, as you also nicely summarized, what we are focusing on is on mice as a model of myocardial ischemic injury. The guideline that was published in 2018 took a more general approach, and it encompassed all different animal models from rodents all the way to large animals and pigs, and focused on the overall cellular and tissue events that ensue the ischemic injury in the myocardium. So given that mice are the most commonly used rodents in animal models, mainly because of the availability of the transgenic models, in this guideline, we present the different experimental approaches that are used to induce ischemic injury in the heart. And we try to highlight how each model is suitable to ask a different scientific question. For example, permanent LAD ligation or non-perfused MI triggers a different set of cellular and molecular responses compared to temporary ligation, which is also called perfused ligation or ischemia reperfusion. What we highlight in this guideline is that one model is not necessarily superior to the other, but each addresses a different set of scientific questions. So as long as we know what question we want to answer, we can find the right model to use. What we also do in this guideline is that we provide some general guidelines and ground rules in terms of how to design a good experiment, a comprehensive experiment, how to use males and females in all the experiments, how to decide on what sample size will give you a good statistical power. And also we touch a little upon the statistical tests that you can use depending on the number of variables that you have included in your study. So basically, we just try to provide some ground rules when it comes to studying these ischemic injury models in the heart.
Thank you, Zam. Christy, before we get too far into this podcast, can you briefly summarize for our listeners what the major differences are between reperfused and non-reperfused MI?
Of course. Thank you, Jason. So for both the non-reperfused or permanent ligation model and the reperfused model, the surgeon ligates a left anterior descending coronary artery. The main difference is in the non-reperfused model, the surgeon will leave the ligature in place for the remainder of the study, while in the reperfused model, The ligature will be removed after a predetermined time, which can range from between 30 to 90 minutes, depending. Upon release of ligature, this will initiate reperfusion, mimicking the therapeutic interventions in post-MI patients. Because of this distinctions in the surgical procedures, there are differences in the timing of inflammation and the extent of alveolar remodeling, which is why, as Zam already mentioned, we put in within the manuscript why each model should be considered carefully when deciding which would best address the experimental question.
Thank you, Christy. John and Dominic, I found Table 1 to be quite interesting and informative. As you evaluated those recent AJP Heart and Circ publications on MI, what surprised you the most, and what do you think are the biggest opportunities we have to improve moving forward? Let's start with you, John, and then hear from Dominic.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah, I think looking at Table 1 in the manuscript, I think all of the points are really important. But some of the things that really stood out to me, or some of the things that we've already touched on, is the lack of rationale provided for using the reperfused model versus the permanent ischemia model. And I think this is important because it sort of helps the reader understand sort of where the author is coming from. You know, what is the actual point of the study, and what are they trying to really look at? Are they looking at sort of mechanisms for protection, of which that is the case, then they need to be using a reperfusion model? Or if they're doing more of the inflammatory response or long-term remodeling, they would use the non-reperfused model. And just stating that in the paper, I think, would be really good to help the readers. Another thing that I found interesting was on the reporting of anesthetics and analgesics, as we found that only 79% reported anesthesia and only 37% reported analgesics. And these could be very important as people look in the literature, because anesthetics and analgesics could influence sort of the size of the myocardial infarction. And this could be very important if you're looking for inflammation and you use an anti-inflammatory drug that could be required by your IACUC at your institution. This could influence your outcome. And it would be very important for a reader to know that as they could sort of interpret your results. Those are the two things that I found important.
Thank you, John. Dominic, anything else to add?
Yeah, thanks, Jason. So I completely agree with John. There were several surprising findings here. And to follow up on John's comments, another point that I believe is important to address is the evaluation of infarct size and area at risk when performing reperfused MI. These are key measurements that are critical in determining the accuracy and reliability of the model. And they should be performed using techniques deemed acceptable by the field, you know, that is TTC staining and Evans blue dye, in order to really maintain consistency. And moving forward, I think it's important to make sure authors of all studies evaluate infarct size and area at risk if they're investigating anything that has the potential to influence infarction. I also think it's important to address the rather persistent exclusion of female animals in more than half the studies here, despite well-documented differences in cardiovascular physiology and pathology between males and females, as well as NIH and other initiatives regarding sex as a biological variable, which should require sound justification for exclusion of one sex. Similarly, while all but one study reported mouse strain, the majority did not specify substrain. For example, C57 Black 6 mice, whether from Jackson, NIH, Charles River, Taconic, et cetera. And this can have significant effects on physiological endpoints related to cardiac injury and remodeling, as was shown in a study from Rong Tian's group published in AJP Heart and Circ back in 2013. So going forward, I think as a field, we have the opportunity and the responsibility to include both sexes in our mouse studies and to provide as much detail as we can regarding our animal use.
Thanks, Dominic. And I couldn't agree more with all those points, particularly the sex is a key biological variable. That's certainly something AJP Heart and Circ has renewed its commitment to here in the recent years. Crystal, in many ways, Table 2 represents the meat of this guidelines paper by summarizing the key recommendations for future MI studies, as well as the submissions to AJP Heart and Circ in this area. While all of the recommendations are very informative and important, what would you say are the top 2 to 3 recommendations to pay particular attention to in that table?
Thank you very much, Jason. So I'll admit that I might be a little bit biased here because I study cardiac electrophysiology, but I think recording of an ECG and reporting some of the parameters that are measured with the ECG is extremely important. Not only can the ECG be used to look at changes in the QT segment, but one of the simplest things that you can do is just monitor heart rate during the ischemic period. And in this table, I think we make a really important point that it's important to control heart rate because that has such a profound impact on oxygen utilization and metabolic rate of the heart during the ischemic period, that changes in heart rate during that period can, of course, impact infarct size. And I think that that's something that can often be overlooked and can be controlled in some ways by careful control of depth of anesthesia. But if, for example, you have genetic models that maybe have differences in resting heart rates, that's at least something that needs to be recorded and reported and accounted for when interpreting the results. Another important thing that we point out is some recommendations for a cryo injury model of MI. So we've already discussed reperfused versus non-reperfused MIs and how no model is necessarily better than the other. And there's certainly a role for cryo injury models to produce a very well-controlled, potentially uniform infarct size. And for those studies, we highlight that it's really important to control for and report all of the parameters regarding the probe, including its temperature, how large it is, how long it's in contact with the heart. All of those details are really important. And so one thing that I would like to recommend is, and something that we do in our lab, is although the surgeries can typically be performed by a single microsurgeon, in our group, we always have an assistant in the room whose sole job it is to monitor all of these parameters and keep really careful records so that the surgeon can concentrate on the surgical approach and the animal welfare, whereas the assistant can really carefully document all of these parameters, which then can be used in interpreting results and then, of course, reported when the articles are written up for publication.
Those are excellent points. Thank you, Crystal, for sharing those recommendations. Rich and Ganesh, continuing along the lines of key recommendations from this guidelines paper, Table 3 is also quite informative by clarifying key inclusion and exclusion criteria for both models. Reflecting upon Table 3 and these inclusion-exclusion criteria for quality control, what are the most often forgotten by investigators that the field really needs to double down on? Rich, let's start with you, and then we can see if Ganesh has similar and or additional insights on this topic.
Thank you, Jason. I think Table 3 highlights all of the things that are often forgotten by investigators in the field, and they're critical. As Crystal alluded to earlier, ST segment elevation is the classic indicator that you have occluded the artery, and labs should be conscientious to make sure that they're seeing ST elevation, both in the reperfused and non-reperfused model. And I think, as recommended, also visualization of the effect of the vessel occlusion should be performed. And so we've routinely done in our lab both monitoring of ST segment elevation and also photographing the heart so that you can see that visual change when you don't have blood flow to that specific area. It gives you an initial indication of, do you have the suture in the right place so that you know, is the infarct going to be too small? And that's brought up in the measurement of infarct size. So I think it's always important that when you're doing these studies, that you have controls that you do to make sure that your infarct size are consistent in your wild type mice, especially when you're doing genetically engineered mice, to know that you're always getting a greater than 30% infarct size measured in that acute phase of the 1 to 3 day. And so we routinely every week have several mice that we do just to make sure our surgeons are on track with consistency. And the other is to have the surgeons blinded to the studies. So our surgeons are blinded to the studies. So there's no influence that might be subconscious to how they're doing the studies that could influence the outcomes.
Thank you, Rich. Ganesh, anything to add?
I just revisit to the figure one because many points are covered by emphasizing the analogy of pinching and punching to the myocardium. Reperfusion is a microinjury similar to pinching, while the non-reperfusion is a macro injury like punching to the myocardium. That differences are compared at structure, function, and survival and molecular level in figure one. And the many points are already covered by Rich and Crystal.
Thanks for that analogy. I think that's a great one. Steve, these guidelines papers are an intense process. I still remember the amount of work and coordination for the one I was involved with a couple of years ago on sympathetic neural recordings across various species that Emma Hart helped to lead. Three quick questions. One, what was the hardest part about writing this up? Two, how long did it take? And three, what advice would you have for anyone thinking of putting together a guidelines concept for AJP Heart and Circ leadership to consider?
Thanks, Jason. That's a great question. Right off the top, I would say, well, you just do whatever Zam and Mary tell you to. But I mean, you know, kidding aside, you know, beyond just doing what the corresponding authors tell you, that reflects there is the leadership that's in place. So, you know, I wouldn't encourage folks to be too selfish about it and to worry too much about the roster of authors. You're not always going to have the opportunity to collaborate with the folks that are on this podcast and the rest of the folks on the author line. But I tell you, knowing who is leading it definitely gives a great deal of confidence to that, because the leadership of this is going to keep the message on track and keep you on time. And time, of course, for all of us is quite precious. And the other element that that allows is that your time is spent very efficiently. And what I mean by that is the leadership can delegate responsibility to one or two, three folks. This is what we need to do, and this is when we need to do it. Now, all of that said, it sounds very austere and somewhat draconian. It's not at all. It's quite welcome, and it's nice to have the organization having leadership give folks, you know, their peers, their colleagues, in some cases their collaborators, the space to collaborate creatively, and that is to add, amend, adjust, modify the initial structure that's laid out and shared with the larger team. Of course, then, you know, once they have this team, as mentioned, you know, it's a lot easier when you have a great team with complementary expertise that has been selected very intentionally, not just reaching out to the usual suspects or, you know, and actually intentionally reaching out to folks that are beyond one's typical circle or beyond a very small group, because this is a large group of individuals to deal with. The other would be the cutting room floor. Make sure that you have room on your cutting room floor. Every guideline cannot have everything. Some things just need to be prioritized, and they need to be left out for perhaps the next iteration or another guideline that deals with the topics as appropriate. So those are the main issues in terms of advice that I would give to others. In terms of time, well, you know, it depends. I've done these with other groups, and some of them are extraordinarily long in terms of the calendar time and in terms of your actual time that you spend doing this. But if there is a sound leadership and a really great group of folks with expertise involved, it feels like nothing in terms of time. It was certainly a joy to do this.
Thank you, Steve. I think one of the things that we see in the field is people sometimes are skeptical of creating conflicts of interest. I wonder if anybody has a take on that. Many of you I know are likely on study sections. Is collaborating on a guidelines paper like this represent a conflict of interest or not from your perspective?
Rich here. I specifically asked my program officer that question, and they said that it did not.
That was my impression as well.
Jason, I think I remember Mary also mentioned if it's a review or a guideline, it will not be considered a conflict of interest.
Thanks, Sam.
Jason, Steve here. I've asked multiple SROs. I use the very practical approach. I point out to them, I say, this is the relationship. I get the response that it sounds like Rich and perhaps Mary via ZAM has had. They point out that this view this like a multi-site, multi-PI clinical trial. You know, if they were to be conflicted, then no one would ever be able to review clinical research because there are so many conflicts that are created from that level. So yeah, should be no problem. Just point it out. You know, it's like their old saying, if in doubt, point it out, right?
Exactly. And thanks. And I just thought it was applicable given the question about what advice do we have for people thinking about putting together a guidelines concept? I think we need to have our readers, our listeners, and our individuals we represent know that they can work with the NIH policies on this. Zam, I'd like to circle back with you on a final question I have. From your perspective, what audience is this guidelines most directed towards?
I think this guideline will be a very valuable resource for any new investigator or actually any investigator who wants to start studying myocardial ischemic injury. And to be honest, given the comprehensive nature of this article, I think even experienced investigators will enjoy reading it. So this is one of the blessings and the curses of doing an article with experts in the field is that everybody has an opinion and that opinion has come from years of experience. So in order to come to a consensus, there was definitely a lot of back and forth and round discussions, which made it a lot more fun. So I really recommend this article to anyone who has any level of interest in myocardial ischemic injury, and I hope they enjoy it.
Thank you, Zam. Are there any further perspectives anyone would like to share regarding this guidelines paper that we haven't covered yet?
I would like to comment on what Zam just talked about, that there really was a lot of back and forth between experts in the field on trying to come to consensus on some of these issues. And quite frankly, on some issues, we didn't necessarily reach a consensus because we felt there might be different recommendations given the specific circumstance. And I think that this guidelines article has done a good job of presenting a couple of viewpoints in those situations where there really maybe isn't one perfect method or approach for a particular recommendation.
Jason, this is Rich. I think the other thing that we didn't touch on is the comprehensive table 4 that really provides, I think, a great outline for people who are, you know, new investigators or junior investigators that are in the field, trying to have a checklist for them to work off of. It's fairly comprehensive, but I think these are the things that you need to think about as you're setting up a program that's going to be looking at ischemia reperfusion injury and myocardial infarction models and the mouse models.
Well, on behalf of AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology and the entire scientific community that will benefit from these concise and clear recommendations, I want to thank all of you for your hard work and efforts with this paper. These guidelines papers are not easy to pull together when done right, and we appreciate all the time and energy and intellect poured into this effort. Kara, back to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.